Going fishing. Australia's nuclear technology podcast. Hello, listeners, and thank you for joining in for the second half of my interview with Mark Richards, Secretary of the MEU, or Mining and Energy Union of Victoria, based in the Latrobe Valley. Clarifications listed in the show notes as per the previous episode. We'll get right back into it. Please enjoy. Have you heard about this Hazelwood big battery proposal?
In terms of batteries replacing power stations, while I've heard of the Hazelwood battery, I wouldn't hone in on that because until those things are finalised, they're not necessarily of much use, those commentaries. I'd probably go closer to Yallourn, which is definitely pushing for a battery. They're pushed for a 350 megawatt battery. But you've got to be very careful about these specs that you hear. The power station essentially had four units of 400 megawatts each, plus or minus a bit. So while you're looking at that and you're putting a battery in that's 350 megawatts maximum capacity, that's only for limited number of hours, probably 4 hours. So you've got a quarter of the capacity or less, and it's only good for 4 hours instead of 24 hours essentially. And batteries are a net user of power. You have to charge them. Essentially, what they'll do is they will shift renewable energy to a different time that you might want to use it. Or it might be charged by coal at night and then pushed out when the prices are high. And while everyone says batteries are fantastic and they'll keep producing them, that's not necessarily the case. The batteries that have been put in first, like the Tesla battery, they took the cream of the price of the market. So when the price goes sky high, they use a battery to produce power and they make a massive income from it. You put another battery in, you've halved that profit, put another one in, it keeps dropping down. So you get to a point where it's not going to be as viable. If the government's propping up, that's a different story.
Other podcasters and commentators on this often talk about the size of car parks when it comes to different generating stations. You know, coal and nuclear often have very large car parks which provide a lot of employment. The same cannot be said for solar installations, for wind farms, and also for batteries. What is the implication of sort of these energy technologies for jobs in the region?
Well, when you go from a thermal power generation, which is essentially burning coal to produce steam that produces a spinning turbine and then electricity, you're talking probably 1,000 direct, well, call it 500 to 1,000 direct jobs at most power stations, and then you'll have the contractors coming to do the work. It could be 3,000 in total. It could be more depending on what you're doing. Then there's major overhauls fairly regularly. When it comes to solar and wind, essentially you're getting the component from China. There's no really Australian jobs. There's one, I think, manufacturer in all of Australia for solar. There's not that much money in it. Even Germany some years ago stopped producing wind turbines. There was no profit in it. So it's a race to the bottom in terms of cost. The jobs associated with solar, well, we've done a study some time ago where you go to a solar panel installation and the tubes are put in by backpackers on holidays. So they were not necessarily, could have even been cash wages. They then even bolted up the panels. And some even went to the point of, you know, running the wires, just not plugging them in. They get an electrician to come along and connect them all up and test them. So there was very, very little unionised or skilled jobs, very, very poor pay. In fact, it's usually a third the pay. So there's really nothing there. And you'll see that there's a fence. They leave them locked up and you come in there, mow the lawn, spray the weeds, wipe down the panels, and that's it. So you might find there's a half a dozen jobs there if you're lucky. Half a dozen. Low paid, irregular jobs. So there's nothing for the community, and that's not even going to the side of the waste cycle. There's not even a recycling opportunity for those either.
Can you speak to the end of life recycling opportunity for a lot of these wind turbines and solar panels? Some people say everything can be recycled, and I think technically maybe that's true, but if we can't recycle plastic bags, how are we going to recycle solar panels?
Well, you're spot on. Every time you create a new technology and people thought plastic bags were the duck's guts, considering that we used to have the paper bags, used to break. I'm old enough, I can remember the paper bags at the shopping centres. Plastic bags have had some unseen consequences. definitely. Solar panels, well, there's a lot of chemicals that go into building a solar panel. That's not even accounted for. The recycling's a major issue. There is no real recycling. I mean, there's the aluminium frames on most of them. It takes a lot of energy to recycle those. Turbine blades are another one that are absolutely shocking. They're essentially like fiberglass yachts. You can't really recycle them. They're just burying them in fields, essentially. There'll come a time that maybe it'll be economical to dig them up, grind them up and use them as a filler material in something, maybe with roads or something. But at the moment, there's really no process. It's the old story. You make generation by using materials. Coal is from the ground. If you go to batteries, you have to do the same thing. You have to dig up rare earth minerals, and those rare earth minerals have a lot of chemical processing to separate them, and they have waste products. So there's no simple solution where you just click the fingers and say we can replace coal with X. I think most people in the industry understand coal is CO2. At the moment, the planet has an issue with reducing CO2. So if you're going to burn coal, you've got CO2 issues. You either have to capture it with amino acids, which don't work too well, or you need to do something different like hydrogen, or go the complete other way and run nuclear, which has no emissions.
Jeff Russell is a man from South Australia who blogs on energy transition and issues like that, and he's possibly one of the most green, most left people you've ever met, but is pro-nuclear. And he's made the astute observation that because of the requirements for energy storage and batteries, the Greens now have a minerals or mining policy. Care to comment?
Oh, look, where do you start with comments around energy production and capturing waste and alternatives? I mean, nothing in life is free. Everything has a product. I mean, coal, we get it so cheap, we burn it, we have emissions. It's an issue. We can't really do much about stopping the CO2 emissions. That's been proven. It's very difficult, very expensive. So you go down the other alternative, solar and wind, you've got a lot of waste products. I mean, coal, we burn the fuel that goes out in the atmosphere, and it's attributed to 100,000 deaths a year, I believe. So you look at the other alternative, it's nuclear in my mind, in terms of what accounts for all of its waste material. The only energy production method I see is essentially, probably hydro is pretty good. There's not too much once you've built the place. Once you've built the concrete and the CO2 from that is accounted for. Hydro is probably one of the best, but no one wants a dam built over a pristine environment. And there's only so much of a river you can dam, and then you're dealing with ecological issues, fish, etc., etc. So I think you're boiling down to the fact that if you want renewables, you're basically talking about digging up rare earth. If you go to uranium, you're talking about small mines, small land coverage. I mean, solar panels, when I was in Germany, I went over there to have a look. You can see hill after hill after hill covered by them. That's by the main train lines. I don't think that's a great use or great for the environment either. Nuclear does seem to capture all of its waste. The waste byproducts can be recycled. I think they're not doing much of that due to the fact that it's cheaper to just dig more up. It seems farcical that Australia exports uranium and doesn't utilise it. We're one of the very few countries, I think it might be the only G20 country that doesn't do it. I'm not quite across that. I think out of the OECD countries, there's 50.
I think Italy had nuclear and has shut it down, but is still technically connected to nuclear plants via the European grid.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I mean, I'm quite aware. I look at, on Twitter, for example, there's one video which I reposted. I actually think it's fantastic. They show all of Europe and their emissions in colours, and they use, I think, the figure 350, parts per million under, and they show only three countries basically keeping under the emissions, and that is essentially Iceland, I'd hate to use the term three men, a lady and a dog, and thermal power, and Sweden, a very limited population as well, but they have nuclear. And then it's France, which was 70-74% nuclear. And they're the only country that keep under it. Now, all the other countries, even Germany, gets their power from nuclear-provided countries, or when that isn't there, they get it from Prague as coal. So it's sort of farcical when I look at, if you genuinely care about the environment, you need to, and we genuinely believe it's from CO2. If you believe those two things, then you have to look at a zero-emission CO2 energy production process, and all I see is nuclear. I don't see gas. gas, everyone talks about gas being not so bad, but every gas generator I've seen around here, except for Newport Power Station, they use a jet engine, which just puts the exhaust straight out to the atmosphere with no real heat exchanger. They then also use gas from the rigs offshore, which are producing fugitive emissions of CO2, which aren't put into the system. So they're about the same as brown coal for emissions. There's no step change. We've been trying to deal with this stuff from last century. It sounds old, but it's last century we're talking about it. And all we're doing is ramping up and up and up the CO2 emissions. We're not achieving anything of a significant reduction. I think nuclear is the only option there is, but it's about education. And there's a lot of people lacking it. I see those people under 40, lots of them, say to me, we should be going nuclear. They're vocal about it. See those over 60 associating nuclear power with nuclear weapons. It's not even connected. And then you see those between 40 to 60 that really seem to be a bit either way, depends on what they know. And the only concerns they have usually is about waste. But when you say to them, oh, have a look on YouTube at these waste facilities, you can stand next to them. Oh, really? Give off the radiation of a banana, essentially. So when you show them that, all of a sudden their mind says, oh, I didn't know that. How come we never get told? You sure it's true? There's no education. It's lacking from school through to uni. If you want to go to university and do a course, I don't see much there.
Do you have family here?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
What are your hopes for them?
In all honesty, my hopes are jobs. In one, there's jobs. I've got a brother who's got four kids, and there's no real career paths for them in this region. One of them's had a job at McDonald's, which is good, another food place, but there's no career industry I see for them. And they're interested in technical stuff, IT and that, but there isn't that either here. So really struggling to find a future for them. Everyone wants where they live to be the great place it should be, and this place has been kicked in the guts over and over, from restructure through to now. I mean, there's talk of bringing back the SEC for renewables, and while that seems to be offsetting our coal jobs, the reality is it's going to happen. And at least by the government having a hand in it, they'll be able to either take some of that profit and feed it back to the community, or ensure that those people made redundant have an opportunity in that industry. But it's only early days in that area.
Australia has a lot of uranium resources, as you mentioned, maybe about a third of the known terrestrial resources. I think most of that's in Olympic Dam. But we're not utilising them. Why do you think this is? What led us to this point?
Well, not to use one of the French Prime Minister's words, is I don't think I know why. John Howard put a moratorium, basically preventing any sort of energy progress into anything connected to nuclear. My understanding is there was a handful of people that attended Parliament that time and voted it down. I mean, I think it's like a dozen or something versus 130 that are supposed to be there. So it wasn't even a blink on their radar. Who knows? Maybe at the time he was concentrating on coal exports. Don't know.
2 decades on, we're paying for the government of the day's short-sightedness.
Absolutely, we're paying for it. And it's not about approving a power station, a nuclear power station. It's about approving the opportunity so people can put presentations forward and invest money thinking, well, it's not banned. You just need to do something. I mean, we're exporting the nuclear fuel. Why aren't we getting the benefit of that?
If there wasn't a ban, do you think nuclear could have a role to play in the Latrobe Valley?
Oh, absolutely I do. I mean, there needs to be an educational process. At the end of the day, if it's safe, if there's jobs and they're well paid, there'll be people come from all over the place to get it. If someone locally doesn't pick it up, someone will travel here for it. That's what happens. I think the issue you're going to have is education. I mean, when a government bans talking about it, no one exposes the positives of it. They don't, you know, we talk about coal and the emissions and people concerned about PM2.5. Well, if you have nuclear, you don't have that. But people need to understand what it means. The economy, how good it is for the economy, they need to know what it means for them. If there was, how safe is it? People don't understand, but people want to know where the waste is, that sort of stuff. And is the waste safe? I mean, I know it is. You probably know it is. But does the general public know that? Where's the education around it?
What? Sorry.
Yeah, go.
What infrastructure, I mean, there's clearly a sell for the Latrobe Valley getting nuclear power,
yeah.
right? You
yeah.
can sort of plug and play almost, isn't it?
Yeah. So in the Latrobe Valley, we have the generations of families that have been involved in the production of energy. We've got generations that have dealt with maintaining steam plants. And for what most people that probably wouldn't even know, but nuclear power station is a steam-producing power station. They use a nuclear fuel to produce power via steam. So all those existing jobs we've got and the maintenance companies around to do it, it's the same thing. We've got turbines, we've got white metal bearings, we've got all that same technology. I mean, in China, my understanding is that when they're scrapping some of their old coal-fired power stations, they're keeping all the power side of it. They're just getting rid of the boiler side of it so they can put their own nuclear steam generators in there, high-temperature ones. So, amazingly, the steam comes out about the same temperature as you want from the boiler. So I think the issue is you need to show people what it means for jobs, how safe it is, what happens to the waste. And people say, oh, but the waste, I don't want to hear in my backyard. But in South Australia, the population voted, I think it was 63%, to support it. You still get some people say, oh, that's not everyone wants it. I said, well, 63% of the population voted for gay marriage. They got it. And what, you don't justify that as being a valid vote? It's just some people have these decades of lack of education, lack of understanding. Assume it's nuclear is a weaponized item.
When you say the 63% there, I think you're referring to the Kimber region and the intermediate waste facility. Is that the one you meant?
Oh, I can't remember what it was. It was that town in
Kimber? There was two. There
South was Australia. There's one where the local community did a vote.
Yes.
There was a small bit of blowback on it because someone said he didn't ask the Indigenous community, but they asked everyone that was a rate-paying resident.
I think, yeah, no, the main difference, I just wanted to get there, it wasn't the whole of South Australia.
It was no,
it was
an area.
It was limited to that Kimber
Correct.
Region. And yes, there has been
yeah.
a bit of...
Yeah, I've read it all back ages ago, but when you read this stuff, well, how many years? Five plus years?
Yeah.
After a while, it's like, oh yeah, no one's paying attention, move on. But
can you give us a bit of an indication of the existing grid and infrastructure that is present in the Latrobe Valley?
So while we've got the expertise of the workers here, what we also have is we have the grid. This Latrobe Valley region had 1,600 megawatts of power from Hazelwood. It had a bit more from Yallourn. It's got Loyang, which is four lots of 500 megawatt units, essentially. You've got Loyang B with another two. So we've got all this power in this region feeding into the transmission yards. Now, no matter what you produce power with, you need transmission lines, and they're very expensive. It's solid infrastructure. If you've closed down 1,600 megawatts of brown coal, you can put in 1,600 megawatts of an alternative energy source. We've got that. We've got the overdimensional roads. So even if you wanted to not produce something in the Latrobe Valley, which we can, but let's say you wanted to produce something in Melbourne in a specialist place, they can drive it down the roads here. We've bought transformers from overseas. We have the capability. We have the local infrastructure. There's no real reason why you wouldn't replace whatever you shut down with new technology in the same region. It makes sense. We might be a regional area, but we've got an industrial heritage, and that needs to be respected and utilised.
Now the title is the Secretary of the Mining and Energy Union in Victoria, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so can you speak of sort of your responsibilities in this role and the role of the MEU to this region?
Well, I did start off with SEC, and I worked at Hazelwood Power Station for about, say, 25 years plus. I was made redundant when it shut, which led me to working briefly a few different areas around the place. I was doing some training for people from, say, New Caledonia that need to synchronise generators to the grid. I used to fly to Perth to train people that were connecting the generators to the grid there and the rigs, etc. But obviously I wanted to come back home, so I'm planning to stay here. And I've always been doing voluntary work for the union for decades, health and safety work for decades, all voluntary. And then I was volunteering with the union as vice president, essentially, and they put me on the payroll. Unfortunately, my predecessor passed away from leukemia, and vacancy was there, and so I ended up becoming the secretary for the Mining and Energy Union of Victoria. our core responsibility is looking after workers' rights, doing enterprise bargaining agreements, making sure they've got good working conditions, and obviously defending workers, you know, from any issues they have at work that they where the boss might be overzealous about something. We don't really, we're not a large union. We're definitely dense. We have a large density within the industry. We cover 95%+ of the workers in this industry. So we've got a key role in trying to do what we can for transition. We were involved with the Hayeswood Transition. We basically created with the government the first worker transition ever, where we had essentially, even though we had probably hundreds of people being made redundant at Hayeswood, many of them were looking at early retirement. There was obviously hundreds that wanted jobs. We worked with Daniel Andrews, the Labor government, to do the first worker transfer scheme, which essentially committed to doing what they could to produce 150 transfers amongst the stations. We only managed 90. At the time, I believe we had 220 people put an interest to leave early. That was essentially people a couple of years from retirement, but there was some financial and tax incentives that if they left early and provided us a gap that one of the younger people at the closing station could move over. So while that was didn't hit its mark, it, to me, I'm quite proud that we've done that. It's 90 families with a worker that's stayed in the region and helped support their family. Where to from here? Well, we don't necessarily lobby a lot. We don't have the resource to lobby consistently. Companies lobby weekly. We know that. So while they're lobbying to get their, you know, their advantages for this, that, or the other with royalties, as we've seen pass and the royalties tax getting knocked off, I mean, they're the sorts of things we want. We want royalties added, but we want them specifically for an energy transition fund. We need it for an energy transition authority. We don't see anyone steering this rudderless ship, and I don't use rudderless in the Kevin Rudd aspect from those days, from, you know, lack of a version of carbon tax, you know, trading systems, all those things that seem to have floundered over the years. We need something at a core that's going to look after workers in our community in this region, and so that is our role, to do what we can. You know, some people might not like what we do, you know, in terms of burning coal, but we're about looking after our workers. That's our core responsibility. If they were shearing sheep, we'd be doing the same thing.
There's many unions across Australia that still oppose nuclear power. Now, the MEU and I believe the AWU broke ranks, especially with the federal and the state inquiries in recent years. How do you explain this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you'd be referring to Daniel Walton, I think, broke ranks. I'm inclined to agree with him. We need cheap, reliable power. I mean, he wasn't talking to us when he made those comments. He could see that manufacturing in Australia was going down the tube because there's no cheap energy. I mean, when you look at the gas is a great one to look at. It used to be $2, $4 and $6. You know, it's low, medium and high. And it sat at $5 for a long time, for many, many, many years. But when that goes up, who's going to be paying, you know, double, triple the price, or what is it now, quadruple plus the price, to produce something when overseas they might have coal-fired power? I mean, one of our nearest neighbours is the biggest exporter, Indonesia, of coal. Even they've signed up for nuclear. And what's Australia doing? Nothing. Well, sooner or later they'll get that up and they'll have a drop in emissions, and we won't, from everything I can see. We don't seem to be doing anything. We keep doing all these changes with the energy sector, but we don't seem to be reducing emissions.
Can you speak of the MEU's relationship with the broader CFMEU? Are you prepared to speak about that?
I'm prepared to speak about that. The problem we have as a union, in any union, is unions have... You talk about breaking ranks earlier. What the general public wouldn't understand is while a union represents workers, they represent their group of workers. So Australian Workers Union has a very wide coverage of workers. The ETU, for example, they look after the electrical trades. We look after mining and energy, but essentially coal. So while we may want a lot of jobs created in our region of coal, the ETU wouldn't, because the ETU is quite firmly of the belief that if they put more solar panels up, they'll have more members. So in some ways, we're in conflict with the ETU in terms of what's their policy. Now, In terms of our national union, we're not really in any disagreements. Victoria has brown coal, whereas the other states have black coal and they have export coal. You can't export brown coal. It's too full of water, it's not economical. If you make briquettes, that's a different story, but that still takes energy. So we're not really in conflict in terms of that. I think Latrobe Valley is a litmus test for where we go with transition. After Latrobe Valley, without a doubt, it's Hunter Valley. Now, I think from where we were maybe some years ago to where we are recently, when the Queensland government made the announcement of shutting down all coal-fired power stations in Queensland, there might be a bit more reaction coming from Queensland shortly. I've certainly seen some already. I don't think there was enough consultation with that from what I've heard, but you're best to speak with someone like Stephen Smyth about that.
Yeah, gotcha. I was under the impression that CFMEU, or the MEU, was part of the CFMEU, and there was friction between, you know, the approach toward nuclear.
Sorry, I didn't pick up on that, a nuance of that. We are rebadged as the MEU, but we are a division of the CFMEU. So the CFMEU stands for Construction, Forestry, Maritime and Mining Energy Union. And at the Victorian level, there was a disagreement, I think, not with our region, but just in with the hierarchy of the union over some, I think, personal, more private matters. And at that point, there was a bit of a separation. And then I think due to the fact that there's a large membership base in construction, I don't know the figures, but let's say they've got over 50% of the membership, that they probably wanted to, I'm not in the top end of these conversations, but they'd want to take control of the of our sector potentially. And, well, they're construction and we're mining and energy, and we've got a long history of autonomy. So before I was in the Mining and Energy Union, or the CFMEU and the Mining and Energy Division, I was in the FEDFA Union, Federated Engine Drivers Associations, and that came from the old days of shoveling coal into the back of a locomotive. So that's where that union come from. But a lot of the unions, there was hundreds and hundreds of them years ago, they were amalgamated, and that's why there's a lesser number of unions. But no, so it's not really a difference. That's more an internal separation. It's not really related to the energy debate.
Yep. All right.
In fact, it's not related at all to the energy debate. It's more about one union wanting to grow, one part of a union wanting to grow and absorb another.
Yeah.
Okay. They're called divisions for a reason.
Yeah.
We're divided.
Do you think Australia is an innovative nation?
I think we absolutely are. We've invented plenty of things. The trouble is we don't seem to have people put the seed money in, or other countries realise there's a better value and they'll take our intellectual property and fund it under their name and off they go. We don't reap the benefits of it.
We should manage our intellectual property better?
I think we should hang on to intellectual property, but you can only hang on to it for so long. What you need to do is you need to utilise it. We need to do it. We need to do things with it.
Nurture it and help it grow?
Well, we do. We don't seem to have a lot of people that invest in growing stuff locally. I mean, I can't off the top of my head think of a lot of the inventions we've had, but we just don't seem to progress them. It's like the cold hydrogen I talked about earlier. I mean, or hydrogen from coal. Let's be honest. That's in the list of trillions of dollars. But why do we have Japan investing? Because they know it's something worthwhile doing. We don't have anyone in Australia doing it. We have Forrester Twigger talking about green hydrogen, but the reality is he's the same person putting out all those emissions from his industries. So is it greenwashing? I don't know. We'll find out.
Stephen Wilson, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
I've heard the name, but I can't picture him.
He's an adjunct professor at QUT, but it's...
Oh, yeah.
He's been on sort of the podcast Rude for a while. He recently released a report on what would be required for nuclear power in the 2030s. So he's been across this for a while, but he multiple times has asked the question, are we sleepwalking back into central planning in regards to electricity?
You mean sleepwalking back to where nothing will happen until the government takes it over? Is that what you mean by central planning?
Essentially, yeah.
I think the worm has turned. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Blind Freddy can tell that the privatisation of the SEC in Victoria has been a complete, utter... It's a disgrace what's happened. We went from having an entity that produced enough to pay for its own debts without any government coffers. It then put money back into the government coffers. I know why it was privatised. It was obviously state government funding issues. But the entity itself was making a profit and had done for some time. So in terms of sleepwalking back to the future... I think it's going to come a time where people realise, and the public I'm talking about, start pushing their own government representative to say, you need to do something, because you've done nothing for so long. In my mind, it's been a case of musical chairs with the government. They're all just sort of hoping it won't be their problem. From the Rudd years through to now.
Previous guests have suggested that the SEC was bloated and something needed to be done about it. Do you agree with that statement?
I think something had to be done about it. It wasn't necessarily bloated like people would think. I think the joke originally came from the initials, from a lot of jealousy too. They were pretty good jobs. There was an issue in that you had very skilled people, and there wasn't such a problem with the work. Everything was done. Every job you can imagine was done. If a handrail needed painting, it was done. So it was a case of keeping something at 100%. Most private industries would run things at 75%. You know, don't worry about that till it breaks. So I've seen the SEC and I've seen privatisation. And the difference I can tell you that's chalk and cheese is when it was SEC, the plant was reliable and well-maintained. When it was privatised, it wasn't. It was basically driven to the ground. It was breakdown maintenance, not preventative maintenance. That's the difference. Now, in terms of the bloat comment, my understanding is that, yeah, it was a big entity. When all of a sudden a region had an unemployment problem, the government might lean on and say, oh, look, can you find a few jobs for the guys out there? Okay, so all of a sudden they put someone on a low income out there painting or maybe cleaning something down. That prevented them catching fire, didn't it? And at the end of the day, when you weigh that up with the social aspect, they're working, they're paying tax, and then you go from that to they're unemployed, they're on a government subsidy of some sort. You know, you look at the difference, and I don't really think it's economical. So, to do that, I think there's a social aspect to it. Yeah, there might have been a bit of fat, but it certainly was way better managed.
Was it punished for being too conscientious?
Potentially, but I look at this. When the SEC was ran, people say slow, easy, comfortable. Let me put it this way: it was ran by a guy called George Bates, who worked out of this office here, this very office is over there. We bought it. The union bought his old office building, the head of the SEC. When it was privatised, every power station had its own CEO, board, reproduced everything, HR, every company that did that. How's that more efficient than one group that did it all?
Yeah, right.
Doesn't appear to be to me. And the wastage I've seen since privatisation has been unbelievable. I remember they did a stores item where we haven't used that in 5 years. Throw it out. So they threw it out. And we're pleading with them, don't throw this out. You'll need it in a couple of years' time, sure enough. They threw out railway line that was special gauge. They threw out special materials that they had to then get made. And it was sold for scrap. It's just, there was no future look when it was privatised. It's, if it hasn't been used in 5 years, chuck it. So that's all they do. You know, it's another CEO every so many years. There's no responsibility. Yeah, one CEO comes in. I remember we had a board at work. It was a fantastic one. Imagine the old-fashioned trophy boards.
No.
And it's, I'm here for the long run. And we had every CEO's name on this as they came and as they went. The only consistency there was the workers. We were the ones keeping the place together, not the CEOs. It's a shambles, the privatisation.
Daniel Andrews, and I believe the election is tomorrow. I've been a little bit behind the ball on that, and this will probably go out after the election. But
I hope so.
one of his promises for re-election is that he's going to revive the SEC.
Mm.
Is this going to be the SEC as you remember it?
No, it definitely won't be the SEC as we remember it. And I don't think anyone could, because the SEC is based on coal-fired power stations. And could you imagine any government saying they're going to do that? I mean, even at one point, the Nationals said they were going to build a coal-fired power stations, and Liberals said, no, you're not. So that pretty much says it in a nutshell. It wouldn't be the same. What I would say, though, is no matter what happens, in the past, governments have been doing reverse auctions on power. And what that means is they put a tender out, they want this sort of built, and they get auctions coming in from different providers. And those prices go down and down, and quite often they take one of the lowest bids. Well, if they're doing that, and it's a private company that's doing it, where's the long-term benefit in that? Whereas if you've got an SEC, you're in charge of it, you'll be reaping the profits from that. And I think that might have a chance to go back to the community more so. It might even provide a transition opportunity. Let's say you've got someone that's a fitter or something in a power station that shuts down. There's an opportunity they might be able to go across to the renewables one. If it's a private company, It'll be the usual dog-eat-dog application forms. They might take people from elsewhere. Companies don't like to train, so they might just get someone that's already worked on a previous project. If it's state government-owned, you might find there's an incentive for that entity to train people, to put them through TAFE, to use locals, to retrain those in the industry that are already there to go across. The wages, won't, I dare say, won't be as good, but it's an opportunity for people, if they can afford to stay in the Latrobe region. If we're losing the jobs here due to coal, we should at least be getting the renewable jobs here. At the moment, they're looking to go offshore, but they're offsetting our jobs here. So I think it's a good start. It might also be enough to get a fund going and some more management and whatever comes next. It might be renewables now. In the future, if it's a state government body and it's the SEC, there's no law that says they can't then go to nuclear when the main federal law's dropped.
When was the right time to go nuclear?
When was the right time? When was the right time to go nuclear?
When was or when will?
Well, the right time is gone. We should have done it already, let's be honest. I mean, the moment we did the Paris Agreement, which was, I think, 2016, and they realised that meant CO2 emissions, if there was any decent scientist that understood the grid fully, they would have said, well, you can do some renewables, that's fine, do them. But at the same time, in parallel, you should be doing nuclear because it's the only generation that's going to reduce the emissions. Start the industry up. My understanding is in France and or Canada's methods, it's either 7 years or 9 years from the equivalent words of zero to hero. So we should have started back then. The moment we signed on to the Paris Agreement and the technical advisors got around it, they should have started doing it. Oh, and by that way, just because we should have started and we haven't, there's no time like the present to be serious about it. We need to change the legislation to at least allow people to start investigating options. Why would you not have every tool available to you to solve this climate change and jobs? You need every tool available in the box. Why are we not having those opportunities? I look at nearly every article I see on power and the industry. That's what I mean. It's my industry. And every article I see, including The Guardian, including Sky, they pretty much all of them barely ever touch on nuclear. You never see the N-word in an article. The first thing I do when I see an article about energy, I will literally Google the article, or I'll search for the keyword nuclear. If it's not in there, I think, well, it's not an in-depth article. I'll still read it, but it's on a backlist. If they're not talking about it, even if they talk about it and say it's needed in 10 years, at least they've mentioned it. They're not even mentioning it.
Has there been a failure of leadership in Australia?
There's been an absolute failure of leadership, but let's not say there wasn't attempts by leadership. We've had attempts by the likes of Kevin Rudd. We've had the attempts by Gillard. We had the ridiculous attempt by John Howard, and successful attempt, by the way, of banning nuclear. So there's been all sorts of people involved, pro, for and against energy change. It's been difficult. It's cost numerous politicians and parties their elections. Everyone is gun-shy around energy. They're absolutely gun-shy. And one thing I will note, and I'm more than happy to say this publicly, is I've written letters to both sides of government at a federal level talking about how we should be looking at nuclear and like to discuss what the opportunities are from coal and coal to hydrogen. And they're very gun-shy to talk to us. But yet I noticed that after the last election when the Liberals lost, all of a sudden they're going out crowing about, let's go nuclear. Fantastic. They should have done it when they were in, but they didn't. So it's quite ironic where I sit when I've written letters they haven't responded to, and I know they've received them.
I was speaking to an associate who, has been talking to one of the industrial bodies that speaks to government. When Scott Morrison's prospects for re-election were looking solid, they were definitely advocating for the announcement of a reversal of the nuclear ban in Australia. Further down the road, when Scott Morrison's prospects were looking rather grim, they were very keen to reel that back in and say, no, don't take this repeal to a losing election, or it will set the whole issue back by a decade. It's quite interesting to see the amount of planning and strategy that is going into removing a ban that was basically placed on the whim of a handful of senators 20 years ago.
Well, if they started the education, they could. Yeah. I mean, people don't really understand nuclear. They seriously don't. I've had many debates with people. And it's amazing how many people, when I've given them details and a couple of links, turn them around. It doesn't take a lot of effort, but you've really got to push people to look. People are, you know, we're all lazy at times. There's only so much time in the day. I'm hoping, you know, that with a bit of education, a bit more masses will come through. But unless you're doing it in schools, it's not going to. We're not going to see it in our working careers. And I do mean that. We really won't see it.
Can you expand on the federal political landscape in Australia subsequent to the legislative ban of nuclear power?
So over the last, let's call it from 1998 when John Howard basically banned nuclear. You've had Kevin Rudd, Gillard, basically try to bring in emissions reductions. Failed so. Governments have lost their seats over this. We get to the position now, decades on, we've just wasted an opportunity to reduce emissions. Since 1998, essentially, when John Howard banned the opportunity to research nuclear, we've had Gillard, we've had Rudd, numerous governments lose their positions in terms of trying to reduce emissions. But no matter what happens, we're never going to get renewables to cover that gap. The political inaction now is still stagnant. We had Morrison do nothing when he could have. Turnbull, I thought there might have been a chance, but nothing. But what we end up with at the last, very last federal election is we had the Liberals talking about it at the last minute, and of course, nothing from the side of Labor at a federal level. Now, what I would say is it's unfortunate from where I sit that Chris Bowen, Minister for Energy at a federal level, has been utilising the conversation to make fun of the situation, whereas I think he should have been more silent on the matter, and he should have thought carefully about it, because it's not about political point scoring here. We're talking about an energy market that's in dire straits. We're talking about, you know, the whole eastern seaboard with restrictions not so long ago. It's all right to have a plan, but why would you ostracise something for political point scoring? I find that disappointing on a personal level. So while we've got all of these failed attempts to sort our energy market out, and a complete failure to even have one of the best tools on the table, nuclear, as a discussion point, we now end up in a scenario where Labor's in using for point scoring. Well, I want to hope that eventually, and I'm a Labor supporter, and I like to see him in as long as possible, I want to hope that when Labor is out, that Liberals don't sit in their laurels and they actually commit to what they said in opposition, and that is that they believe nuclear is the way forward.
Yeah.
I quite often see politics, you know, as a game to those people, but this is something that affects all Australians, all workers. Energy cost affects everyone. If you haven't got a worker in a, you know, in a steel mill earning money, they're not going to go down to your local shop and buy a coffee. They're just not going to do it. It's not going to happen. We've seen it firsthand in Latrobe Valley. Hunter Valley's next. And energy needs to be taken seriously by all parties. And that includes the Greens, who do a lot of political point scoring on this as well.
Where and how does Australia sit in the 21st century geopolitical? What's at stake?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think we crow a lot about trying to make the Paris Agreement and reduce emissions. But when we don't have all the tools on the table, such as nuclear, not even an option, how can we be taken seriously? We're one of the very few countries, I think the only country in the G20 that doesn't do that. Of the OECD, there's 50 countries. There's only about just over a dozen that don't have nuclear. That's a lot of countries that do. And why we don't even have that opportunity when we're selling uranium to the world is very duplicitous.
Who should Australia look to abroad in terms of policies that create energy security? Whose policy should we emulate and whose should we avoid?
Well, I think in terms of Europe, I mean, there's only two countries I'd really look at. I'd look at France and I'd look at Germany. France has a nuclear fleet they built in a short period of time, in decades. 75% at one point, I think, of nuclear, with the lowest emissions in Europe, I believe. Germany has gone down the way of wind and solar, and obviously that's proven to be a bit of a failure. What's really brought it to the task now is with Ukraine and Russia. I mean, gas has never been the right fuel for energy. It's been there to make up shortfalls or emergency use. It's not the right fuel to be making energy with. It's the only fuel we can do it with at the moment, because that's what's filling the stopgaps. So I think Europe's a total failure when you look at what's happened there. I mean, they're looking to freeze in a lot of places. They haven't got energy security. I don't know where they think they're going next.
Can you expand on why gas is not an appropriate fuel to use for electricity generation?
The thing I see with France is with nuclear, you know you're producing a constant power source and you've got a closed cycle in terms of waste. When it comes to Germany, they've got solar panels. I don't see them being recycled. You've got wind farms. They're not really dispatchable. They're just putting out power when you need. So you need to top that shortfall up or to balance the grid out with frequency with gas. Gas is a finite resource. So sooner or later, it's going to run out. You can't be, you know, it's like burning coal. Gas is just another form of natural fossil fuel. And it has emissions, has CO2 emissions. When you drill for it, you have methane emissions, way worse for the atmosphere than CO2. And you've got fugitive emissions that aren't even calculated. So the emissions from gas, it's not the right fuel to do it. And at times you might want that fuel for vehicles. You know, in factories they use gas. Those sorts of things are for mobile use. I don't see a point in burning gas to top up and match renewables on the grid. It makes no sense to me. Even geothermal sounds like a good thing at times, but that's not it's a finite resource too, as Sweden has shown.
How do you think developing nations are going to solve their energy needs?
Well, we've seen lately they've been using other countries' exports. That's a short version. I mean, India's got a massive population. China's got a massive population, and a lot of those places want to grow. Any second world, third world, they all want more power. If we don't have an alternate system worldwide that's zero emissions, you can forget about Australia's measly 1% of CO2 emissions. If you've got a massive population in India and they all want to all of a sudden have air conditioning, how are you going to provide that? If you provide it with coal or gas, you're going to have a massive problem on your hands in terms of emissions. If we're talking about global warming, global cooling, climate change, whatever it is, you'll need to deal with the CO2. Unless it's nuclear, you're at a whipping to nothing.
Are renewables alone sufficient to support these nations?
Absolutely not. Well, that depends, actually. If you only want power for part-time of the day and you're in the remote area in Africa and you just want it so you've got power so you can pump the water out of a well or something like that, or have, you know, battery storage for school lighting or something, that's fine. But if you want continuous, reliable power at a cheap price that lets industry grow and lets your country you know, manufacture things, recycle things, and have consistent jobs for people, you need cheap, reliable energy.
Do developing nations have the right to fossil fuels and development as we have enjoyed in the Western world?
Every country has its sovereign rights, let's be honest. Now, if Papua New Guinea, one of our neighbours, I won't use Tassie as a joke, but if Papua New Guinea decided that they were going to open up a massive coal mine because they could produce cheap power, who is Australia to say they can't do that and they shouldn't be using their coal resources, for example, to make a cheap coal-fired power station? It's hardly fair for us because they need to bring their economies up. They've got the same problems every country does in terms of growing their fleet. Maybe it's, if we're going to talk about reducing emissions worldwide, maybe we need to be investing in helping these countries skip that step of CO2 production from coal and help them go straight to nuclear. But we can't do that when we're a fledging nuclear nation of our own, to be honest.
We need to sort out our own backyard before we can criticise others.
Oh, I can say that. I mean, yeah, it's fairly obvious. Why should Australia have the right to dictate to other countries about not using fossil fuels when we're using them and we haven't got an alternative they can use?
What does the Latrobe Valley look like 20 years from now with the correct leadership and energy policy going forward? What is your utopian vision, if you will?
Well, big question, that one. A utopian Latrobe Valley. I guess at the core of it, I would probably have to say, and this is going to sound a bit basic, but I think the core of it's got to be jobs. Now, everyone talks about sustainable jobs. Most people don't have a clue what that means. I think you need something that is ongoing. It needs to start with jobs. Once you've got jobs, everything else lines up. When you don't have second, third generation unemployed, you've got people with meaning in their life. You don't have this sense of where am I? You know, a lot of people are like, what are we here for? What are we doing? Well, if you're going to work, you're busy enough, you have less time for that. Come home, you've got money to do things, you can go on holidays with your family. It'd be nice to see, you know, a replacement industry in this area. If it isn't something, well, we're not going to have coal. That's fairly obvious. I don't particularly want to look out the window and see windmills going around everywhere or turbine blades. I'm more than happy enough to have them out of sight. I can't imagine, you know, solar's got too far to go. I'm not particularly wanting to see a whole bunch of mines dug up just for batteries. I'd like to see the place, you know, thriving with people that have their families here generation after generation. That takes growth. I mean, I've been to France, I've been to Loire Valley, I've seen the nuclear power plant over there. Fits in well, the community there thinks it's great. I think it's going to sound ridiculous focusing your utopian on jobs. You know, it'd be nice if we all didn't have to work, I guess. But I do see that the misery we've had brought to this region has been the loss of jobs and loss of economic wealth in this region. So economic wealth generally comes from jobs. I don't imagine we're going to be giving people in our region money for not doing anything. So
jobs perhaps provides the impetus for money to flow.
I think with a job, you've got an opportunity to put your kids, you know, through to if you want to send them to uni in this region and you want to send them to a course that's not in Latrobe Valley, you've got to pay for their accommodation in Melbourne. Most of the time, the kids will have to work. It's pretty tough. Whereas if you've got a good economy here, thriving, long-term jobs, like when the SEC was here, there was no threat of anything closing. We have arcades that have shut down and never reopened. If we had a thriving community, they'd prosper. People don't have the money they used to have. And it shows. It shows on the streets. It really does. So utopia, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to talk about butterflies and parks. We've got a few of those. We've got no shortage of beautiful fauna and flora around the place. You know, we've got a beach down the road. We've got snow up the hills. It's a great place. Good rivers. You should get out to Walhalla one day. It's beautiful out there. Last town in Victoria, I think, to get electricity connected. And it's a beautiful place.
What is the way to get to this utopian vision? Can renewables provide it?
I am absolutely positive we won't get to utopia from your renewable jobs. It just won't happen. I mean, if they were making the bearings for the wind turbines, if they were making the gearboxes, if they were casting the casings, if they were doing all the electrical wiring for the lightings, for the tubes, if we were even rolling the tubes for the wind turbines here, I could see prosperity. We don't even have a machine in Australia that can roll the tubes for those wind turbines. So if we can't do that, which means it means we're importing it, we're not value adding on our steel or our ore. So I don't see any possibility of a utopian future or wealth based on renewables. I just don't see it. I do see a reduction in emissions, I do see that, but I only really see it as if we have a new industry. If it isn't nuclear in terms of replacing energy, then we need to do something like manufacturing of fertilizer or of explosives or a chemical or making pharmaceuticals, something high value that's ongoing that we'll need forever. We're all getting old, we all need pills, so that might be the future, who knows. But we need someone to build it first.
Mark Richards, thank you very much for appearing on Going Fishing.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Going Fishing would like to thank Mark Richards for appearing on Going Fishing and providing his time and insight into something that is clearly very close to his heart. The Mining and Energy Union website and contact details for Mark Richards will be listed in the show notes. Until next time, thank you very much for listening. This has been Going Fishing, hosted by Logan Smith.